Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. Special thanks to WKDZ, your Ag Edge Network, for their help in bringing you this show. On this week's show, David and Jay will sit down and visit with Dr. Chad Lee from the University of Kentucky to discuss lessons learned from 2021 and how we can improve for the 2022 cropping season. Dr. Lee will also join in on our discussion this week, discussing this week's topic, considerations for fertilizing wheat and nitrogen shortages. And we will wrap up things with this week's timely tip. As always, thanks so much for joining us. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, David, good morning.
Doing very well.
Chad, how are you this morning?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
We've got Dr. Chad Lee with us. Chad is an extension professor with the University of Kentucky and the director of the Grain and Forage Center of Excellence in Princeton. So we're glad to have you today. It's a time of the year when a lot of folks are looking forward to spring and thinking about getting ready for that crop season. But for where David and I live in the western part of the state, we deal with a lot of wheat producers, and wheat's already in the ground, so we appreciate you being here to talk with us today. And, you know, give us just a little bit about your thoughts of this last crop season, kind of where we were with 2021, and what you might think we might have learned from that we can carry over into the next year.
Well, you look back at 2021, first off, it's going to be one of the best crops that we grew in Kentucky. Corn, soybean, and wheat yields were all up, and for many farms, it was the best or close to the best yields they've ever had. In addition, it was also good economic prices for those crops, and so many farmers came out doing very, very well in all three crops. If I look at some of the things that I think we learned, if you look at some of the research funded by the Kentucky corn growers, what we've seen over the last 4 or 5 years is the need to do side-dressed nitrogen applications on well-drained soils. That's new. So in the past, we knew we needed to do side-dressing on poorly drained and somewhat poorly drained, and you get into some of the fields in your counties, you've got a lot of those type of fields. But historically, on the well-drained fields, that wasn't as important. But these last 4 or 5 years have shown that not only do we need less nitrogen when we side-dress, but we also just get better yields overall. So it's double... It's a double benefit to the producer to figure out how to side dress if they can.
Do you think that with the coming fertilizer prices, this is going to be even more important than what it has been in the past?
Oh, absolutely. If farmers are trying to figure out where they can shave a little bit here or there, side dressing, or more than a little bit, right. Side dressing is certainly an option. I know that that's a challenge for farmers that aren't set up to do side dressing. It's a logistical challenge because of the time of year when that takes place. But if they're looking at areas to save money or areas to invest, that's probably the first place I would look.
Yeah, and also, you know, even talking about putting P and K on in a different form, we talked about this on our last show. You know, how do we go about learning from the past? And you know, because this used to happen a long time ago. We used to put P and K in a row. Do we go back to doing some of those things to try to shave the dollars off of that bottom line?
Well, certainly you can look at doing some 2x2 placement or banding, if you will, outside of the furrow.
Right.
And if you do those things, you can cut back your rate by maybe a third of your P and K, based off of what your soil test is telling you you need. And you're able to cut back because more of it's closer to the root zone, and you're. It changes your long-term dynamics of how you might manage that field, but that's certainly an option. And there's some other countries where that 2x2 placement is the way they go about it because of the economics of it. Again, it changes if you're going to stay with that long-term, it changes some of those strategies that you do longer-term. Probably the second thing is I think we have a lot of growers that are putting out P and K that may not need to. Let me back up. You got to have adequate P and K, right? It's got to be there. But if your soil tests are in that high or moderately high range, this is probably a year you don't need to apply it. In fact, our recommendations would say you don't need to. It'd be a year to follow those recommendations and pull from that bank.
Well, something you touched on there is a soil test. we've talked about it all the time. We certainly talked about it on last week's show, but regardless of when you usually soil test, this is the year to do that. Even if you made a complete soil test of everything last year, I think now is the time to know exactly where you stand going into this next season. We've been talking with producers at home, David and myself both have, about just what you said, being ready to mine some of that back out of the soil if your soil test will allow you to. And the only way you'll know where you stand is to have that soil test. So.
Oh, absolutely. And we used to say, I think the old recommendations maybe 10, 15 years ago were to pull a soil test about every 3 years in the field. That's been moved up to 2 years. If you're in irrigation, it's every year. But I agree with you, this season, it makes sense to do it again. And let's back up for a moment. One thing that we got to step back and think about, not counting 2021, 8 of the last 10 years were 10 of the wettest in the last century. So we've been in a wet trend. This last year was no different than those other 8 years I just talked about. There's probably 9 of the last 11 are probably in that top 10 in the last century. So we've really shifted the weather patterns that we're normally used to getting in our fields. And so some of the things that tells us is that our yield potential is higher. That's why we're seeing the benefit to side dress now that we probably didn't see before. It probably gives us some confidence that we can plant some higher populations out there on corn and try to capture that up-end yield. You know, a lot of farmers looking at shaving 2,000-3,000 plants seeds per acre. That's not the place to shave. You want to maximize your yield potential, and on your very deep, very well-drained fields, the fields are less prone to drought. You probably need to be sort of between 34,000 and 36,000. You get into those eroded slopes, and you want to back off to as low as 24,000. And if you're at 36,000 on those eroded slopes, and you get some drought that comes in, then you're going to have a crop failure in that area. Your yields will be less than if they were at that 26,000. So, you know, farmers can fine-tune populations, and a lot of them do. A lot of variable rate out there already. But I think when they're looking of ways to adjust and try to cut back, that's not one place to do it.
Yeah, and seed costs probably, of all the things that are going up, you know, fertilizer, different inputs are going to be a lot higher, chemicals, this type of thing. Seed costs are probably going up the least of anything. So being able to fine-tune those may be the way to go this year.
Yeah, yeah, so absolutely.
Chad, you mentioned backing up there, and that's what I want to do. I want to back up even a little further. We're talking about issues related to fertilizing our wheat crop. How critical is it going to be for folks to get that great initial stand right now and know what they have? What's in the ground's already in the ground, but how important is that to make sure they have an optimal stand when it comes to addressing side dressing nitrogen?
So you're talking in wheat. So obviously getting a good stand is pretty critical. We have a little bit of flexibility if the stand isn't ideal where we want it to be. There are probably some wheat fields that got mudded in this year, and so we'll see what they shake out to be. The one thing that we have the advantage of with wheat is we're looking for an ideal tiller count of somewhere between 70 to 100 tillers per square foot at about Feeks 3. So that's typically late February. If you're in that 70 to 100 range, that's about the ideal range, and so your nitrogen at that time would be about 40 pounds. Then you'd come in about the end of March at about Feeks 5 and put the remainder of your nitrogen on. If you're below that 70, in February, then you'd put on 60 or 70 pounds of N. You're trying to stimulate tiller production, and you're trying to get that population up where it needs to be. On the flip side, if you're up over 100, which is rare, but if you're up over 100, you'd put no nitrogen down at that February timing. You'd back off. You don't want to get too many tillers, and you also don't want to end up with lodging issues. And so, you know, we can over-fertilize corn, and usually it's just darker green. We over-fertilize wheat, and it's going to lay down on us. And we know
that's a problem.
And we know exactly where we made those mistakes, right?
Well, you mentioned the excessive moisture in recent years, and we certainly have seen that this year. Thinking about how we manage our nitrogen, initially when that wheat crop is seeded, we rely on residual nitrogen from the corn to get it up and started. In a year like this, where we're having outstanding yields across the state, coupled with the added moisture, Do you think there's going to be enough residual nitrogen really to get the crop off and started? What's your thoughts with that on how the wheat looks across the state?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I don't argue to anybody that puts out 20, 30 pounds of nitrogen in the fall. Usually they're putting it down in their phosphorus, and so it's coming along with it anyhow. Probably wouldn't argue with it this year at all. When you look at the corn yields that we had, corn was pretty efficient at using nitrogen this year, so it's not as much left over. Let's get into the nitrogen dynamics a little bit, and then you need to talk with Josh McGrath or Edwin Ritchie for more details on some of this aspect. But when you have frequent rainfall events, it's stimulating microbial activity, and that microbial activity is releasing some of the nitrogen from the organic matter and making it, and it's a plant available forms. And so we do know that when we have more frequent rainfall events, go to irrigation, for example. We know in an irrigated setting, we get more release of nitrogen in that setting than we do in years where there's big gaps in rainfall, or definitely years where we get into drought situations. So there's a little bit of that in there too. So you're going to get a little bit of just residual nitrogen being released because it's not been cold up until recently. It's been a cool fall, and we've had good activity that way. So I'll back up. Again, if you needed phosphorus and you put it on, you've got 20, 30 pounds of N, that's certainly fine. That doesn't necessarily count toward what you need to do for your adjustments in the spring. And when we're talking about these split applications, February and March, Feeks 3, Feeks 5, that's with the mindset of either using UAN or urea. The other option, if a farmer can get it, would be ESN, the polymer-coated urea. And if it's polymer-coated urea, you'd want to put that on basically at the end of January in one shot because it's a slow-release mechanism. We did some studies years ago where in those studies it showed that if you did the normal splits with ESN, it didn't give you enough nitrogen early enough in the crop. You had to put that on in January.
Chad, tell us a little bit about, I know that for our listeners that maybe don't understand about wheat, and wheat is grown in a lot of different areas of the world. And, of course, you always hear about England being, you know, first and foremost from a wheat yield. You hear 200, 250 bushel wheat. Tell us a little bit, and I kind of got into some research for this subject. Kind of, they were planting in 5-inch rows, and they were putting on three applications of fungicides, and they were doing all these different things on the front end, it seemed like, to get them a good crop started. So tell us a little bit, maybe just for those folks that don't know, a little bit about maybe climate changes that are different over there than they are here, those kind of things.
Sure. So first, you're at a much more northern latitude. Great Britain is around 50, if I remember right. We're sitting at between 37 and 38 for most of Kentucky. So they're on par. They'd be north of Minneapolis in terms of latitude, which is one big difference. Now, it's not a Minnesota temperature where they've got warm currents from the ocean coming in. Their climate's closer to ours in that regard. But what it allows them to do is their wheat crop grows for 11 months, different than ours, right? So they plant it about the same time we do, which is, you know, October, maybe September. And they're going to harvest that wheat in August, somewhere in there. And the field will sit idle for about 30 days. And in the middle of that 30 days, they'll do the heavy tillage in most of those fields. There are some farms that are switching to minimum till, no till. They'll do some heavy tillage. They'll put wheat right back into it. And there's a push in England right now to get other crops in rotation. So part of it is it's a continuous cropping system, and so there's definitely a buildup of some diseases that they're dealing with that way. Second biggest thing that they have because of their latitude is they have a longer seed fill period. We get longer seed fill periods if we've got cooler temperatures during the seed fill stage, and that helps us out. They, because of where their latitude is, they end up with a seed fill period that's almost twice the length of ours. If you start thinking about trying to protect that crop from certain diseases, that's a lot longer time to go, right? It's longer than most fungicides are going to last.
That's right.
So there are some big differences that way, but it's that longer seed fill period that really contributes to the very high yields that they can get. And so in their system, when they do intensive management, their system just is going to yield better than our system. It's really, really hard for us to compete with that in terms of the seed fill time that they have. And they're 11 months. Ours is coming off in 9.
Yeah, it makes a really big difference, really big difference. But I was trying to, you know, and their attention to detail to me on the front end, seeding depth, seeding rate, getting a good stand to begin with, I think is so important. And we've kind of switched to, I see a lot more no-till fields in wheat than I used to, for sure, even in that McLean area. But then I live, of course, in Hopkinsville, and a lot more no-till wheat down there over the 5-10 years than it has ever been.
Definitely.
So, you know, I think those are some real keys for folks in the wheat business to that attention to detail on the front end.
Oh, I agree completely. And I've been to England once. Would love to go back. COVID kind of messed that up. I was actually looking at some long-term wheat plots over there. They have some plots that are 140 years now, I think, where it's been in continuous wheat, and they've got grain samples that go back to the very first year. Some really, really interesting, from a research standpoint, just some interesting things to study and look at. But I'll tell you, and I looked at some of their equipment, and particularly some of the farmers that are trying to get into no-till and such, really, really valued their efforts in that. But saying all that, I like our equipment. We've got really good technology, and our equipment has improved to the point that allows us to get good stands in no-till, where 20 years ago that was harder to do. 30 years ago it was impossible to do. And so that certainly allows us some leeway that way. We've even got a few farmers now that are they're actually planting with the corn row, and they're using RTK guidance, and they're just missing that corn row altogether with that type of system. Really, really nice way to go about putting the wheat in the field, getting good stands with that. We do know longer term, let's talk about things we're learning for this coming year. We'll kind of switch back into slugs. And let's talk a little bit about herbicides as well. The two tie together here because there's a shortage of glyphosate, shortage of glufosinate, so Roundup and Liberty are both short. That means we're going to rely on other chemistries to help burn down the fields. We're going to rely more heavily on some soil residuals to help us through the season. That's not all bad. The weed scientist guys and this dumb agronomist have been begging farmers for years to put soil residuals in front of soybean. They might actually do it this year. So
we actually touched on that in our show last week.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, and I think that's a soil residual in that program is actually a good thing and needed to be there for years. So happy to see that. But because of these shortages and because of some issues with slugs, where slugs always show up when you've got corner beans that are basically at that V1, maybe V2 stage. It's cool and cloudy, so the crop isn't growing, and you've got residue. And so the slugs hide in the residue. It's cool and cloudy, so they get out and they feed more, and those poor plants are just sitting still. And so that's when we have our losses from slugs, is those three things. Go ahead.
Do you see that more in corn after corn? Do you see it more, you know, corn after beans? I mean, is there any rhyme or reason?
We see it in residue, when we've got residue out there. So it's – and – because of both of those factors, the herbicide issue and the slug issue, I'm guessing we're going to see more tillage show up this spring. I've been here long enough. I really like the advantages of no-till. I like the long-term benefits of it. And hopefully, if folks are looking at doing some tillage, they're going to do 1 to 2 inches of tillage, maybe enough to cover the residue with some soil, disturb those pathways that the slugs hide in and such. And if they did just do that, then that's minimal damage to the overall soil profile. And I can certainly understand why a farmer would be considering that this coming year. But if they are considering it, I would ask that they try to do that 1 to 2 inches.
Is it better to do it this fall, maybe, or winter? I mean, I guess winter really now.
Well, it's...
How early do we do it? How close, how does that help?
You can... When you do some tillage, and you got to be careful with this as well, but when you do tillage, you can stimulate a little bit of microbial activity, and you can actually get about maybe 20 pounds of N released from the organic matter. Now, you're burning organic matter to get there, right?
But and you mentioned earlier that that's already a usable form for plants. So
exactly. It's coming in a usable form. So if you're going to do the tillage, I'd try to do it in the spring if you could. So that you're gaining that 20 pounds of N. We're talking about trying to save on N.
Yeah.
And if you're going to spend the extra money on tillage already for your slug and herbicide issues, try to gain that extra in and use that for your crop as well if you can.
You mentioned herbicide issues. That little bit of tillage is certainly going to help there as far as an initial weed control option.
It's certainly an option on that initial weed control to help clean up a field when you get ready to go. Now, the caveat there is anytime you do tillage like that, all those small seeds are ready to have a flush at
that's
that
right.
point. I mean, my background was in weed science, and we used to do tillage so that we would get a flush of weeds.
You know, I want to make sure and remind our listeners as well, when they're thinking about tillage, to be mindful of their conservation plans with the FSA and NRCS office, because general anything plan that they do might be, you know, opposite of what they've signed up to do or agreed to do. So that's something to always keep in mind.
That's a fair point, and that's probably something where a couple of our soils folks need to be in conversation with those folks to let them know, and the weed folks for that matter too. This is a year where there may need to be some tillage done in some areas that haven't had it for a while. Yeah, those are really, really good logistic type questions. And I think four of the last 5 years, I have been to a cornfield where urea was applied, and there's terrible striping in the field because of a poor fertilizer spread. The fields I visited last year, the folks who spread it were up front and said that there was shipments of urea that in the past they would have rejected. But last year it was what they could get. So they were already feeling, right, exactly. So they were already feeling that pinch last year. This year it's going to be even worse. There's not much you can do. So I think you're forced to be in a situation where you're going to ask them to double spread. I know it's more trips across that field. You're paying for the extra trips. You're running over more wheat in the process. But the wheat's still small enough at that point that that's less of an issue than having an uneven spread in the field. And to your point, you might consider just doing a single pass across it in that scenario. So instead of being right at the end of February, maybe you're at the very first of March getting into Feeks 4 and timing that single shot that way as a way to get around it.
If you have folks that have airflow trucks, that seems to be a little better. It's not as big of an issue as you are.
Absolutely right. They can handle that, but they can handle the odd shapes better. What gets a spinner spreader is exactly what you said before, is usually they're calibrated in for one prill size. And some of this urea is coming in different prill sizes. Fines. Sometimes when the urea is hitting the spinner spreader, it's just pulverizing it,
shattering
it, right? And so you've got these dust trails behind it. And that's the issue that we're dealing with on that. So all of that being said, if you can get liquid, I would prefer that. It's a more accurate way to spray it or to apply it. I think most farmers that are consistently in wheat are set up for that and would prefer that as well. But I also understand that this may be a year where you don't necessarily get to choose which form you want to deal with.
And when you're talking about liquid, you know, we talked about putting it on with stream bars or these fertilizers.
Well, I think in both of those scenarios, you're trying to get that nitrogen down closer to the soil surface and less of it on the leaf, right? And so you're trying to minimize leaf burn in that scenario. And a lot of these farmers will tell you that they don't gamble, they farm. And if they're really wanting to gamble, I mean, they can do flat fans for that matter, and if they get decent rainfall right after it, it'll wash it down and it's okay. they don't get decent rainfall right after it, they'll tell where they've been in the field, right, with some leaf injury on the plant. Now, again, the plants are young enough that even that leaf injury probably won't hurt severely longer term. So for the individual that maybe has a sprayer but doesn't have a streamer bar or some of these other systems, they may find themselves going that route just to get the fertilizer on this year. And, you know, in a perfect world, you'd have some rainfall right there around it to help alleviate some of those burn issues with it.
I've seen some of the commercial applicators, a lot of them do have stream bars, but it seems like some of the farmers have those fertilizers.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they come out in a like a
mm-hmm.
three. Yeah. You know, and it doesn't seem like it's doing as good a job maybe as a stream bar. I mean I know you're getting your nitrogen down, don't get me wrong, but it seems like maybe the leaf burn maybe not as a stream bar.
Yeah, and I'd agree with that. Some of the farmers have moved away from the stream bars because of if they're in a true no-till system, and sometimes those streamer bars get hung up on corn residue and get yanked off, and so they've just decided to go with the basically your T-jet type fertilizer applicators in that scenario. So
it seems like it's helped a little bit that manufacturers have gone to pipes above the frame.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
90s, I had a lot of issues. I had a lot of issues with knocking nozzles off.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's it.
They've come up with a lot of new innovations.
Yeah, I agree. And that's, but chase that rabbit just for a second. I'll give a personal opinion. And that would be, you know, I would like to see it cost more, a little more, but I'd like to see a nozzle every 15 inches so that way I can go in and do side dress on my corn with that same system. It gives me more flexibility. When I go to spray, I can run my boom a little bit lower. I'm paying for some extra nozzles, but I can run a little bit lower. I'm reducing some drift issues potentially with that. And I like that setup when it can be done. I think it gives a farmer much more flexibility to manage a field.
So. While we're down this rabbit hole, and I've been wanting to ask this for a long time.
You hear a lot about
yeah.
Wide drops.
Yeah.
What's your opinion of wide drops?
So wide drops convinced a lot of farmers to do side dressing, and for that I'm very thankful for wide drops, because they actually got farmers willing to try that out and recognizing that can work and can work very well. The idea of it putting nitrogen right there close to the corn stalk is I have no argument with that whatsoever. When corn is at about V6 in 30-inch rows at that point in time, it's got a fair bit of roots that have already crossed the middle of the row, and those roots are already intersecting some, unless you're in a really heavily compacted field. So maybe down in Fulton County, where on those very heavy, very, very heavy high water table soils, the wide drops right there next to the corn probably makes a lot of sense in that scenario. For the rest of our fields, we're probably, even if you just had a single streamer going down, your corn's going to capture a fair bit of that. But I'm not arguing with the system, because the system encouraged a good practice. Yeah.
Soil texture and the clay content certainly is going to have a lot to do with movement once it gets there, and that's the difference between the soils more related like to Fulton County, like you say, and maybe some of the soils in Christian County.
Yeah, very good point. And there's a few farmers that made their own versions of Y drops, and I've seen a few of those out that are pretty effective as well. But whether you're doing a wide drop or you're, as long as you're getting that fertilizer in between the row on corn, you know, like I said, that V6, V7 corn, you've got roots that are going to capture a fair bit of that as well.
So. While we're talking about this, you know, seeing a lot of research with Green Seeker, optical crop sensing equipment. What's your opinion? How does that help us? How does it, you know, what are there some advantages maybe to having that with this nitrogen?
Well, the Green Seeker clearly is a benefit in wheat, and we've got the algorithms for that that our soils folks figured out and ran, and that's a really good setup. Most times the farmers aren't applying less total nitrogen on the field, but they are getting a yield increase from from doing the Green Seeker type system. Corn is much more difficult because corn, usually, if it starts to show a symptom, when it's really young, it doesn't need much nitrogen. And if it's showing a symptom then, it doesn't tell you a thing about the crop later. When corn's at V6, it's only taking up 30 pounds of N. You know, you need another 170 or so to finish out that crop in a good year. So the challenge with corn is if it was going to show a deficiency, it's going to be closer to seed fill or closer to pollination and seed fill. And by then, you don't want to see that deficiency. You don't want to get out there and have to correct. Because if you're having to correct, then you've lost some yield potential. So it's much, much harder to get those systems to work in that environment. To your point on that, it's used quite a bit over in the boot heel of Missouri, for example, on those heavy soils, high water table. They know they're going to have some deficiencies show up just because of the water stress, excessive water stress. And so they're using it in that system, and that makes really good sense in that kind of a setup. But I think for most of your fields, most of your farms where y'all are located, we'd prefer not to have to be in that scenario to use those.
You know, along the lines of technology, for the producers, whether they're in Kentucky or maybe another state who may be listening, who have the technology available to them, is this a year where producers think about tissue testing with their wheat crop?
Well, I think it's certainly worthwhile to do some tissue testing. It's worthwhile to do tissue testing from the standpoint of tracking where your crop is going. It's kind of the same scenario that once you get later in development, you don't want to see deficiencies show up. And so if you're pulling tissue tests, it sort of gives you a recognition that there's something that may have gone wrong. You need to figure out what that was. You may or may not be able to correct for it for this season with the tissue testing. So I think there's tissue testing is kind of like Y drops. It's getting farmers to go out and pay attention to the field, pay attention to the crop, and see what's going on with it.
All right, Chad, you were saying there? I did that on purpose.
I was saying I love the extension conference.
we need that. We need to be videoing that so they know exactly who that come from. Chad, you know, just to kindly point us in the right direction, you've talked a little bit about some of the research that's been done. Where has that research come from, and who's responsible for helping to bring that to us?
Yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, since we're talking about nitrogen management quite a bit, Kentucky corn growers put a lot of money and investment into nitrogen research the last 5 years or so. Tremendous amount of data out there. Josh McGrath, Edwin Ritchie, John Grove has done a little bit. We've done a fair bit, mostly looking at cover crops and some interactions that way with it. But the good news about that is we've got a lot of data here recently in the current wetter pattern that we've been in to really better understand how much nitrogen we need going into next year's crop. And I think it turns out to be extremely timely given what we're seeing going into next season. So we appreciate the corn growers for that. They put a lot of money into some fungicide research, plant diseases in corn. Other areas as well that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head, but the point here is we're trying to figure out how to fine-tune management for next season. Thankfully, we've got a lot of local research funded by local farmers that's going to help us make those decisions.
And it's all because things are changing. The arc changing. Yeah. Weather patterns are changing. And that's very important for the other folks to get involved. They may not be involved in this research. And it's very important for them to understand why we're doing it.
Absolutely, and genetics keep changing. Things are improving. Yield potential is going up a fair bit. We've got better management overall. We've got most of our farmers are now drying grain, storing it, and such. So our quality of grain is going up a fair bit as well. All of those things go into play with that. And when you have local organization like the corn growers and we talked a little bit about wheat. Small grain growers funds a tremendous amount of that research, and soybean board funds a tremendous amount of that research. When you've got the local farmers supporting that research, it means a whole lot more. It becomes a lot more applicable when we start talking about some of that information. And so with that, we do have a newsletter. It'll come out about once a month. We'll do sort of an update each month on what we think farmers need to look for coming into next year in the growing season, recognizing that supply chains may change on us, the economics of some of these things might change as well. And so we'll probably go back and revisit this about once a month as we get into the season.
Sounds good. What's David, you had something to add?
Yeah. Simplest one is kygrains.info. Kygrains.info. That's a mobile first website that Jennifer Elwell helps us maintain and build. And then it'll get you into the official UK website, which isn't as mobile friendly that way.
That's actually one of the that's one of the websites of the KY Grains is one of the places that I used for information to prepare for this
Excellent.
Week's show. So glad to have it. It was handy.
Well, Chad,
before we move on into our timely tips, is there anything you'd like to say just to wrap up that portion, talking about fertilization? Any real take-home message that producers need to know?
Well, I think the final thing would be come see us at our winter wheat meeting in Hopkinsville. We'll talk about that a fair bit, about the nitrogen management and some of the other things like that. By then in January, I think some of the local dealerships will have some prices finally on nitrogen, give us a better idea what to work with. Yeah, maybe. I know they're hoping for it. No. No, my guess is you'll get something the last week in December to allow farmers to take advantage of some of the prepay options that way. Not going to work this year on you. That's right.
We've used the term in weeks past, Chad, prescriptions. And I think this is certainly going to be the year where folks may have multiple prescriptions based upon the fields they're working with, the fertility, the yield capacity of that particular ground.
Yeah. So, I think I would say, assuming you can get all the inputs, keep your field rotations, keep those long-term rotations. That's better off for your farming operation in the long term. I wouldn't. Right, and right now the economics are, they're really trying to push to get more corn acres for next year. You can lock in, Greg Halleck said it at the Farm Bureau conference last week, that yes, fertilizer expenses are up, but so is profit, and you can still make a good profit if you're locking in, if you're able to lock in some of that now. I think there'll be some farmers that will move into beans just because of the uncertainty of it. They want to go ahead and lock in a decision, and they'll switch over to some beans just to deal with that. But if you look, and again, I'm not an economist, so we're getting in dangerous waters. But if you're looking at next fall's delivery prices on the futures, corn's going up and soybeans are coming down. So obviously the market recognizes this as well.
Sounds good. And just to give another plug, you mentioned the winter wheat meeting. It's going to be in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, there at the James R. Bruce Convention Center. 2022 wheat meeting. It'll be January 4th of 2022 from 9 to 3. That's central time for anybody that's listening that would like to attend. Chad, that's been an event that's been held there for a long time. It's certainly a good venue for it. I think in years like this where we're maybe not wanting to be in real close proximity to one another, that's going to give us the opportunity to spread out a little bit, move around, and should be a good venue.
It's a perfect venue for it, and it should be very timely information.
And it's kind of right in the heart of wheat in that area.
Yes.
I mean, I know wheat's grown in lots of different places in the state of Kentucky, but the big dogs, if you will, are that Christian County and
Logan County, right. That's where we see the area of the well-drained mm-hmm. soils that you're talking mm-hmm. about that's necessary
yep.
for that. So.
Good deal.
Well, one of the things we do, Chad, with this show is we like to have a timely tip that we add in. And with us talking about wheat and wheat fertility, I thought a good timely tip would be for folks to actually get out and learn the different growth stages of wheat so they can be more timely in their nitrogen applications. You know, come springtime, be more timely with their fungicide applications. That's certainly the something that's always big. And we know the big guys, like David just mentioned a minute ago there in the heart of wheat country, they have to run when they can run, when the ground allows them to. But for those smaller producers who have the time to get out and actually manage this year, I think it'll pay them well to do so. What's your thoughts on knowing those different vegetative stages of not just wheat, but of soybeans and corn as well, different growth stages?
In general, I think the better you understand those, the better you can time some of your management. The more you can scout, the better you can fine-tune your treatments. You know, $5-$10 an acre to scout, if it's done well and if it's done properly, will probably save you some input costs and will probably gain you some yield and profit on the other end as well. I think that can be a very cheap investment. Cheap in terms of it's relatively inexpensive relative to the gains you get back for it. I think so. Yeah, exactly. I was telling somebody the other day, back when I was in weed science and working on that, and I used to have a matrix in my head that I memorized of about 25 herbicides and about 30 weeds, and I could tell you which herbicides control which weeds and which ones can be mixed together, which one's good and which ones cause crop injury, which ones didn't, what stages, which adjuvants worked, which ones didn't. About 3 years into Roundup, I forgot all of that. That file went out the door. And Absolutely.
AGR6 may get popular.
AGR6 is, yeah, it is popular. I can tell you that. They were clamoring for it last week when Travis first mentioned that it was up and running. AGR6 is online. AGR1, the Lime Fertilizer Guide, is online as well. Comprehensive Guide to Wheat Management that has the growth stages. It's all on there. You can find all of those at the KY Grain site.
Well, Chad, we appreciate you for coming in this week. You've got a lot of things going on this week. If you work in extension in the state of Kentucky, and we're glad you were able to take the time out and join us here. And I want to also thank our hosts for helping put this show together. David, thanks for sitting down with me and putting the information together. And we want to thank our list. Well, we did miss Vicki this week. Vicki's on assignment, I guess you could say. She wasn't able to make the conference, so we certainly look forward to getting her back in whenever it's available. But we want to thank Chad again. We want to thank our listeners for joining in, and we hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.